Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Breitall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 232 for comics originally released on January 18th, 2012. Starting us off in DC is Supergirl number 5. Now, this title is kind of interesting. I'm liking the art. I think the artist is doing a really good job. There was one or two places where she had, like, red eyes, which is a little weird, whatever. But what gets me with this title is it is a solo character title in a very, very real sense of the word, because, or term, we're 5 issues in, and no supporting cast has really developed, you know? And it struck me that this series is... I mean, it's good that what's working for the series is not so much that the character of Supergirl is utterly fascinating, because we don't know all that much about her, really, but the status quo is what they're focusing on. This series is sort of following the path of almost a post-apocalyptic survivor tale. You know, the whole stranger in a strange land, getting captured by the natives, the journey to the wastelands of your people, and all that kind of stuff. And that's kind of working for me. But... you know, again, 5 issues in, we don't really know all that much about Supergirl. What we do know I like, but it makes me wonder long-term, where are they going with this?
Well, they're going to be integrating it into the main DCU. They've got to. I read somewhere that they're planning a Superman family crossover, where they're going to be, you know, they're doing a big Batman crossover. So DC's getting on the crossover bandwagon pretty strong. I think they're trying to cross-sell their books now to shore up the sales that are starting to drop after the honeymoon period. Well, I mean, they were dropping from the get-go, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, so I read that they're going to be doing a Superman family dropover, so I'm going to imagine that they're going to be... I mean, because they've established that Kara is Superman's cousin, mm-hmm. right? Just like in regular continuity. That's not something that's been completely rebooted, like the Superboy character's pretty much been completely rebooted, right? She's been rebooted in the sense that she's a brand new arrival on Earth and we're trying to figure things out. She didn't really believe or understand who Superman was, but you can kind of see in this issue even she's coming around on that a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, so especially with this new character, Rain,
Rain was kind of interesting, because in the solicits, she's called Maxima, who
right.
was the one who was going to try to seduce Superman, all that kind of stuff, wound up joining, what, Justice League Europe or something like that?
Yeah.
And if you look at the character, she looks kind of like a more alienized version of Maxima.
Right.
But I think Rain is actually potentially a better name for the character, and I'm wondering if these world killers are kind of the post-Flashpoint, you know, like, Doomsday race or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, as you were saying, though.
But, I mean, they're going to just try to do something different there, but we're going to, you know, see her getting a little bit more into the Superman mythos, I think, back on Earth as time goes by. I hope they don't overplay too much the alien hostility angle, because, I mean, that's okay, at least for me, that's okay to a certain extent, but then... it just starts getting tiring, you know?
Yeah.
If you've got these heroes where they're constantly being chased after by the suspicious military headed up by General Lane, you know, kind of thing. I mean, that they've done that in the Superman books before. Not my favorite kind of thing. But maybe other people like it, and that's why they're going back to the well on that. And it has nothing to do with this issue in particular. It's just that I keep noticing that as a theme.
Well, I think it's related to this issue in so much as not only do we have that going on Earth, but now we've got this race of aliens, the world killers, who are chasing after her, you know, Supergirl too. So it's kind of they're caught in a multi-front war almost, you know, surviving against, be it the Earth military, these aliens chasing them down, while simultaneously trying to be superheroes. Yeah. And by having that kind of adversary, it really raises the threshold at which their moral compass has to be set or whatever for them to say, not only do I want to do good, but I want to do it against all of these overwhelming odds. So it's interesting.
It could be good in that if we have these world killers come and really start doing a number on the Earth and the Superman family steps up to the plate and saves us, you know, maybe people will start accepting, oh, well, there's good aliens and there's bad aliens, and we like the Superman guys now, and we're not going to be jerks to them continually. Something like that. You know, it's like lead it into moving the status quo back to, you know, you can have a cooperative set of superheroes that are superheroes in the respected as sense, as opposed to the hated and feared and do it anyway like Spider-Man mold, which I don't think is a good template to be applying to Superman family characters.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's the hated and feared, and then there's the actually hunted down to be killed, which raises it another level.
Or, you know, hunted down to be put into a lab and experimented upon.
Yeah. But, I mean, the other thing that's interesting right now with the Superman family is it used to be that the S stood for something because of Superman. Now we've got Superman, Supergirl, and Superboy all sporting kind of variations on it to a degree, and it doesn't seem in this world to have quite the weight it had pre-Flashpoint. I mean, Superman hadn't been around as long, hasn't apparently done as much, and is still, you know, being hunted by the military and stuff. So I think they have inadvertently, or maybe on purpose, devalued the Superman emblem substantially in that world. So we'll see how it goes. I mean, overall, I'm liking this. You know, I thought we got some good backstory on Supergirl and Argo City in this issue that was similar to, but not identical to, the pre-Flashpoint stuff. And, you know, I liked some of the changes they made and how they tweaked it and stuff. So it's just going to be, it may be a little while before we really get a clear sense of what the long-term direction for this character and this title is.
Right. One other thing I like about the reboot on Supergirl is it's not emphasizing Supergirl as Superman's little cousin, you know, kind of thing. She's being built up as a character that really is, by the time they introduce her in a cooperative fashion to the other Superman family members, you're going to have gotten to know the character, and the character will pretty much stand on its own as opposed to, you know, intro, you know, up through N, kind of exclusively as Superman's little cousin.
Yeah.
And I think that was good. That was a good choice.
I agree with that. And that goes towards the plus side of having devalued the Superman emblem. She's not getting accepted just because she has that. She's
right.
Having to earn her own way, her level of respect and stuff like that. And you're right. I think when they gather that family together as a team, they'll be seen more as equals than this is Superman, these are his lesser sidekicks. But it'll be interesting to see how that kind of a crossover goes, and kind of where the characters are at going in and coming out of it. It's just funny how many times I think I've seen Supergirl crash landing on Earth, yet never really having read originally, I mean, I've read in reprints, the original time she did it. So, just kind of funny. So, for me, this was a solid 4 out of 5.
Same for me.
Cool.
We flip over to Marvel, I guess Marvel Icon, for Superior, issue 7. This is the last issue of the 7-issue series by Mark Miller and Lennell Yu.
Now, the way that was billed in the solicitation was the double-sized finale, all in caps, to the best new comic in years, as the first volume of Superior draws to a close and the creators promise the best fight scene they've ever achieved on the printed page.
That's setting a bar.
yeah, it is.
I liked the issue. I didn't recall the solicit. I'm not sure that it measured up to that solicit.
That's a little ambitious.
If that's what they were shooting for, they failed. But taking that solicit off the table, I thought it was a good issue, and I thought it was a good wrap up to the series. I am not convinced that I need to read more superior stories.
I'm not convinced this. There needs to be more superiors. This had a good beginning, middle, and end. It told a complete story. Why do more? To me, that seems like a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the whole point of this series was Simon introducing the Simon character, his friends, you know, how he ended up getting the powers, the conflict, you know, and the resolution, you know, like a good story. And anything that you tag on to that is kind of denouement at that point. And, you know, maybe Miller will come up with some really great idea to, you know, have a follow-on series, but it would be very different from this one, right? Because here you have the whole, I don't know, I don't want to spoil, because some people are going to probably read this in trade. And I would recommend, if you didn't read this, this is a trade, it would be worth picking this up and reading the trade, because I thought it was a very well done story, as you say, with the beginning, middle, and an end, and it's self-contained, and it was really good. And, you know, but the whole point of conflict in here and surprises that they throw at you kind of partway through the story and then how that all resolves, you know, I like the twist, and talking too much about it would just ruin the story for people who haven't read it.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. This is something that, if you haven't read it, it's worth getting in trade. To me, this is a good story in the terms of a good summer blockbuster movie kind of a story. Not a good, you know, in-depth, you know, deep introspective, you know, kind of a Watchmen, or, you know, it's not that kind of a story. It's a good roller coaster ride. It's fun. It's got a good premise. It does pretty much what you would expect from aspects of it. Does a couple of twists here and there. But if you're looking for the, you know, the best fight scene in ages, or the deepest plot, or the most introspective thing on what is, you know, this, that, or the other mean, or what, I mean, it's what's it mean to be a hero and stuff, you're not going to get that here, nor should you expect to. The big fallacy...
Well, unless you read the solicit, then you might expect to.
I was going
to
say, the big fallacy here is the solicit. And that's part of why I dig these things up before reading the stuff, is I want to know how they pitched this thing. I mean, I liked this fine. It was good. But, you know, was it the best fight scene they've ever achieved on the printed page? Well, I don't know what else these two, as a team, have put on the page for the best fight scene. But, you know, the solicit goes on to say how, you know, the fight's in the middle of New York and thousands of innocent people die every time someone throws a punch. And I'm like, you know, I really didn't take that out of the comic. You know, to me, this fight scene was okay. It was good. Pales in comparison to Scott McCloud's Destroy one shot from back in the day, which really showed how much damage a superhero fight could do.
It pales beside Superman versus Doomsday the first time, you know?
Yeah. So, there are a lot of things here that I think they could have... They told a good story, but they really could have kicked it up a notch and stuff. You know, I was at the end of it thinking, it's like, well, heck, you know, even Tad Scott didn't seem to die. I'm like, wait a sec. You know, this is a guy who had a bus thrown at him, and he's a regular guy. What the... Oh, and there were some things with the art, you know, on, like, page 6 or something, that was almost lost in the shadows. And I'm like, you know, a better artist would have tweaked that panel just a little bit. You would have flipped over. You would have had this great splash page of what should have been a key moment in the story when the hero first enters the fight.
Right.
And, you know, what they had was fine. What I think...
I think that you're right, though. On that page in particular, the choice to have that panel so small in comparison to the first panel on that page was... Yeah. Artistically, not the right choice, in my opinion. But, you know, I'm no artist. I'm just the consumer of the art, as it were. So,
I would have flipped this page around to where you have the bad guy throwing the bus as the bottom two panels, flip it mirror image to where he's throwing it into the bottom right corner of the page from his perspective. Flip the page. You get the other side of the bus now coming. And you get the hero or whatever. I mean, there's a lot you could do visually there that would have been really cool and played up the comic book aspect of this. And, you know, it's not like they made bad choices or anything, but when you're hyping this as the best new comic in years or something, and like it's the be-all, end-all of stuff, it's like, well, you know, you're setting a bar that I feel okay measuring you against.
Well, you know, Miller is not the most modest creator out there.
No,
so, you
know. No, he's not. But really, what he set out to do here is
He told a good story, though. I mean,
he
got
a good story
that
could be turned into a movie.
Yeah, which is what his niche in comics is.
Yeah, that's his goal. He set out. He did it.
He pretty much writes comic books that get shopped around to Hollywood, and a decent number of them get made into movies. So more power to him. You know?
Yeah, this is something that, frankly, I think would be fun to see in a movie. So I got no problem with that. Again, when it says, you know, this is the first volume and we're going to get more, I'm like, I can't see something that at the end of this is begging for a sequel. Yes, sequels could be done. They could be brilliant. But this is also one of those things that had a really good sense of closure, of ending, and was a satisfying final issue. So, you know, I'm not saying, oh, wow, they left me hanging, they got to give me more, or anything of the sort. For me, rating this was a little hard because, again, it was good but not great. I'm right on that edge between a high 3 and a low 4, you know?
I gave it a solid 4, you know, for me. It was actually, for me, the story and the ending was a solid to almost a high 4. I thought it was very well done. You know, and that is given the fact that I am not the greatest Lentil Yu fan in the world. You know, some people really love his art. I think it's okay when it's paired with a really good writer and, you know, the pacing is done well. I like his stories, but there are some people who seek him out as like a favorite artist, and it's like, oh, I want to buy pages of original art by him and put them on my wall and stuff. Those kind of people, this will probably make their I'm sure they've already bought this, right? Someone who's like that is not going to pass up this series, and it'll make their head explode in its awesomeness. That's not me, but I give it credit in that he's not my favorite artist out there. And I still really enjoyed the story. So did a really good job on this, you know, some pacing issues aside and, you know, some artistic choices that I don't think I would have made. And, you know, you pointed out a good one in this issue, and there were others like that. But that's just, you know, it's kind of one of the reasons why other artists, you know, are probably higher on the favorite list.
Well,
because they're more in sync with, you know, making choices that communicate the story better to you as a reader, whereas other people, you know, maybe that's a good way for it to be interpreted for them.
And it's easy for us to sit here with a finished comic book and say, well, they could have done this better or differently, versus starting with a blank page.
Right.
I totally see that and totally understand that. So I'm not trying to come down, you know, when I make those types of comments against any artist or anything. If anything, it really goes back to a common theme we've had of, it goes towards the editor, of they could have kicked back and said, well, gee, what about? I'm going to go with a low 4 on this. There were enough places where I think aspects of it were concept-wise a little derivative, execution-wise a little predictable, art-wise a little, you know, unimpressive. But overall, just like I would expect that out of a summer blockbuster movie, I'm not expecting high art or the most original plot or the most in-depth characters or whatever. I'm looking for a really good story. This delivered on that, both in terms of this issue and this series. So they should be pleased with that. And, you know, if they go for another one, I'll consider if I get it or not. But they need to have a really good pitch as to why I should. I liked this, and I would not necessarily want a sequel to risk diminishing this.
Right. Now, on your editor comment, in general, in comics, editors don't seem to take that much of an active hand, although in the DC relaunch, I think it's the needle has swung way far in the other direction, and the editors are in some cases kind of running roughshod over the creators, especially in the case of like Static Shock. I don't know if you read any of the stuff, but John Rossum was putting up on the web about, you know, how that situation went. But,
no,
you know,
I haven't read any of that.
That's something we can talk about in another episode. But it's on my agenda of, like, you know, editors and comics. But, you know, my point is that Marvel in particular, the editors seem to really be in the role of traffic cop and not in the role of making the story better and, you know, artistically. And especially when you have a creator-owned book with some pretty I don't even want to say that. You know, it's like, but it's a creator-owned book, and I'm sure that the creators have a very specific vision. I don't think that someone who's a freelance editor for hire that's brought in by them has any latitude to make that kind of suggestion on how to change a story.
I disagree.
Not that they shouldn't, but I just don't think that they do.
I think they are being paid to do that kind of a job, and maybe they're not. But if I were in, you know, the position of I've got this creator-owned stuff, I've got this artist, I'm putting the book together, I'm having it come out through somebody, and they have an editor, I'm expecting that editor to read it over, check it for, you know, typos, for, you know, story continuity mistakes, whatever. Now, they could come back with a laundry list of stuff. I, as a creator owner of the property, could say, great, I'm going to do all of it, or I don't give a damn, I'm going to do it as is. But I think that the editor should be offering suggestions, whether they get listened to or not, and do it in a manner where it's very clear they're not expected necessarily to be listened to, but this could benefit everybody. And if the creator owners are not taking advantage of that, that's on them. That's unfortunate.
And who knows what actually went on behind the scenes on this one. All you know is that a couple questionable art choices made it to the printed page.
You're right. It could have been that things were much better and the editor said, well, let's change it to this because that'll be cooler, you know, or nothing at all. You're right. We don't know what happened. It just seems like when you've got an editor who can act as that test audience and things get past it, in this case, I don't think anything serious or catastrophic got past it, but we've seen a couple of cases where it's like the editors fell asleep on the job. You know, the dialogue balloon's wrong or something that's just not a stylistic or execution choice, but
that
actual
kind of
mistake.
Stuff is just, that kind of stuff, it just jumps out at you because no one's going to say, oh no, leave that horrible misspelling in my word balloon, or no, leave that, you know, balloon pointing to the wrong character. You know, that's the kind of thing that no one would disagree with, you know, whereas a story pacing or, you know, how you're showing, you know, we've talked about different times like that, you know, some suggestions like that. Someone might say, hey man, I'm not going to go back and redraw a bunch of pages, you know, because of that.
Mm-hmm. And again, that's their choice, and I respect that.
So we're going to move on to our indie book, which is the first. We have a couple this week. First one's Prophet, and it's Prophet number 21, and it's the relaunch of the Extreme imprint, which was Rob Liefeld's studio. And this one's interesting. They're not starting with a new number one. So just on the face of it, I'll be really curious when we do the numbers on this, if the number 21 of Prophet has any different kind of a profile. It's an image book, so it's, you know, it's likely going to be selling under 10,000 anyway. But, you know, does it have a vastly different sales profile than other image number ones, if you know what I mean?
Well, I think that'll be less obvious with the first issue, but by the time we get to the third, if it has the same kind of drop-off between 21 and 22 and 22 and 23 as between a real first, second, and third issue. You know, and I frankly expect that it will act as if it were really a number one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we see this kind of a honeymoon period restart every time you get, you know, a new creative team on an existing book, sometimes even with the first issue of a new story arc.
And the reason I'm curious about it, just to be clear, is that, you know, there's so many times when, you know, someone tells a story and it goes from issue 1 through 6, and then they purposely start it over again at number 1 to get the increased sales of a number 1 as opposed to doing a number 7. Now, that could be the case that it's, you know, if there's not enough time separating it. I mean, it's been so long on this that, you know, it really has, and it's such a departure that it's being treated logically as a number one regardless.
Yeah. It does have me thinking it would be funny for somebody to do a comic book where, you know, a couple of pages in, they make some change, and they've got a panel that's like the new number one kind of a cover, and then they keep going for a couple of pages, and then another change, and then it's a new number one panel, as if they were going through multiple first issues within the span of a single issue. I mean, it would kind of go towards how some comics are told these days. Jeez.
Yeah. So this story, it's a complete reboot from the old Prophet series. And I interviewed Brandon Graham, who's writing this, you know, back a few months back about his King City trade paperback. And also we talked about Prophet here. And not only is it a reboot, I mean, Brandon never really read the original Prophet comics. So it's not, you know, it's not any kind of a thematic follow-on either. And I never read any of the original Prophet comics, you know, so we're really coming into this fresh. And I thought he did a really good job on it in that, you know, the premise here is that Prophet at some point back, you know, and again, I'm not sure how the original story went, but he ended up in some kind of cryogenic suspension pod or something. And now thousands upon thousands of years have passed and the pod pops up to the surface and opens up and out pops Prophet, and we're in a completely different world. I mean, it's this really weird, trippy future world, you know, with like weird beasts and kind of pseudo alien races, and it's kind of like this post-apocalyptic journey of discovery, really, that Prophet is going through here with just some really off-kilter, bizarre stuff going on, which if anybody read King City, you know, it's like some weird stuff, you know, went on there. And I think that's Brandon, the sensibility that Brandon brings to a book like this. But it's not to me anything like I would have expected a direct follow-on to an old Extreme Studios title to be. I mean, it's kind of like the difference between when Rob and gang were doing Supreme versus when Alan Moore came in and did Supreme, you know.
I would say in terms of the amount of difference, yes. In terms of the increase in quality, I would disagree. No, I mean, this is no Alan Moore Supreme, so I guess what I'm saying.
Well,
yeah.
It's a matter of opinion. Right, yeah, it's like Alan Moore Supreme was playing to your sweet spot, let's just say, versus this, and this is something that's really weird. This is not going to appeal to everybody. I loved it personally. This is something that is playing to my sweet spot, and qualitatively, is it Alan Moore? No, it's not Alan Moore.
Well, yeah, a few things are,
but personally, I loved the book, and you know, I would rate it right up there with my enjoyment level with issues of Alan Moore Supreme. So,
okay, you know, interesting.
I gave this book, this is a really high four to me. It's you know, and I can understand to when I was reading this, the whole time I'm reading it, in the back of my mind is, well, John's not going to like this at all. You know, it's just not the kind of thing that I think would appeal to you. So I'll be interested to hear your specifics, but I can see you legitimately giving this a not glowing rating from your own personal enjoyment level, because it's a weird one.
Well, let's go with that, and let's expound on that just a minute, because I think you're right. I read all of the Prophet stuff back in the day. Now, this is stuff that came out back in 1993 and 94, 95, so do I really remember all of it? No.
I would be really interested, though, to hear, like, thematically, what, if any, kind of parallel or, you know, any kind of similarity or difference that you just remember from having read it 20-some-odd years ago to this?
The best thing I can say is he was kind of, again, the lone warrior. He was, if I remember correctly, and it's been 15 years and I've read tens of thousands of comics since then, literally, he was kind of sort of almost their Punisher equivalent at a high level. So we see aspects of that here where he's going on the mission and all that stuff. So is this John Prophet potentially the same character as the one back then? Yeah, probably, possibly, not necessarily. But, I mean, just going into this, there were a couple of things that had me kind of, you know, curious towards, annoyed towards, unimpressed. You know, when it starts with the hyperpod underground and burrowing up to the surface, I'm like, okay, that's interesting, that's different. Don't know why it was buried down, why it had to burrow up and all that stuff. But, you know, it had an internal sense to it, and it worked. You know, but then we get the page where, you know, he's getting attacked by the wild animal, and it's very alien. And I will give the credit to the creative team of, you know, like you said, there's stuff that's very alien, very out there, very different. So in terms of a sense of style and a unique vision for their world, they succeed tremendously. But then he whips out this knife, and I'm like, where the heck did that come from? I mean, I'm not seeing that anywhere on him. I guess maybe on that first page it's kind of alluded to there in the first or the second panel or whatever. But, you know, then we get the inventory panel. Like, what the heck is this, a video game? You know, it was nice to have all that kind of laid out and stuff. But by this point, we've also gotten a lot of, you know, captions of narration. And it quickly got to where this story was feeling like it was narrated to me versus being, you know, me watching it unfold. And it felt more like a documentary than a drama. And that was really taking me out of the story. You know, again, they've got an interesting new world for this issue, but a lot of it I'm learning about from the narrator, not from the story. And it was too much of a, hey, look at this alienish thing, and not enough either depth or context or grounding to really make me care about those alien things. It's all, hey, it's cool, but I felt there was a lot of setup, no real payoff in this issue.
Well, I think that depends on when it's like, hey, it's cool, if you do not agree, then that's going to take you right out of it.
Well,
right?
To me, some of it wasn't a matter of agreeing or disagreeing. It's if I were to watch a sci-fi show and all they were doing was whipping out the technobabble and the gadget of the day and stuff, and I never really felt I got to know the characters, or all it was a toy shop kind of a thing, I'd be kind of unimpressed with that. And I
right,
like sci-fi.
That's to me, that's not all that was happening here.
No, I would agree with that. There were other things. He's got a mission that was set up hundreds and hundreds of years in the past, so somehow they were able to predict all of this, yet not correctly predict when he'd come out of the thing to go do the mission. I mean, there are a couple of things story-wise that already didn't quite make sense for me. And there were a couple of places where it was a little bloodier or gorier than I care for, but nothing that was so, you know, oh my god, you know, kind of a thing. There were a few that were pretty damn close. And if I'd loved the issue, the gore level and blood was something I could probably deal with, but frankly, I just didn't love the issue, and a lot of it was the storytelling style. You know, this issue failed to hook me on the character, the premise, the plot, the storytelling style. There was nothing I could latch onto and say, this is why I would get a second issue. I agree that there is an audience for this series. It's well done, but I'm just not part of that potential audience. You know, I read the PDF copy for review purposes and stuff. Don't really feel the need to go add this issue to my collection, much less get the next.
I'm not surprised at all by that. No, that kind of plays. I mean, this is going to appeal to a different type of comic reader than you tend to be, and that's not right. That's not mm-hmm. nothing wrong with that, right? It's just I loved King City, and there are parallels here. Well, although Brandon Graham's not doing the art and writing on this, he's doing the writing. You can really see a lot of the storytelling influence that he, you know, had, you know, the inventory thing that you allude to. I mean, that's the kind of thing that he tends to do. That's a very Brandon Grammy kind of thing. Or when they get to that Unaka meat farm, you know, where you have the panels with the arrows pointing down and the little kind of insets kind of pulling out. You know, it's kind of stylistically. I mean, he's working with this Simon Roy, who's a new artist. I was kind of looking him up online. He hasn't done that many things before. Nothing that I had really popped in my head. But he's got I like his style. I think it matches the story really well. And it's got a different enough feel to it than other things I'm reading that, and I, again, it's something that appealed to me. So it was another selling point of this series to me, because I like these varieties of art style. Some of the coloring choices I wasn't that fond of. You know, I think some of the coloring schemes came across to me as a little, I don't want to say flat, but I'll say uninspired. You know, it's like a little bit too monochromatic, you know, and I can understand, you know, you're going down into this organic beast kind of thing, and the lower and lower you get, it's got like this very red cast to it. I think it was too overdone and too dark, and it obscured the storytelling to some extent. Then you pull to some of these other scenes, and it's like predominantly blues. You know, it's just I'm not that big of a fan of most times when a creator makes the choice to tell individual scenes primarily washed in a single color scheme. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make the art and storytelling pop as much for me. So that's the kind of stuff that kept this from being a 5 for me, really. But, you know, I really liked the story a lot. So I think it's something that people should check out. I mean, to my recommendation would be go to the comic shop, or they've got some samples of this online at various places. If you do a search on Profit plus Image, you probably could find an online, you know, first 5 pages or something kind of thing for this. I might even have had a link to the preview of it back when we did that interview episode with Brandon Graham. But, you know, worst case, just if you're at the comic shop, flip through a copy. I think if you flip through a copy, you're going to tell right away, is this something that looks interesting to me or not?
Well, you know? And I think if you got and loved a title like Fear Agent, you should definitely check this out. I see some basic parallels between that. You know, different character, different setting, but there are similarities with the alienness and the going on the mission. And it seems like the audience that was just in love with Fear Agent might fall in love with this pretty easily.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, this was a 3 out of 5. It wasn't bad. It just didn't work for me. And a lot of that was the pacing, the storytelling style. You know, it felt like it was a combination of documentary / video game, where it's like, okay, he gets the power up, so he's going to chuck this and use this other piece of his inventory instead. You know, and it just didn't click with me is what it came down to.
Yep. So next up, we've got Dead Man's Run from Aspen. Now, speaking of editors, and one of the things they do is make sure there's not like egregious typos and things like this. I got this issue pops out of my DCBS box, and I'm looking at Dead Man's Run, number 2 on the cover. I'm like, number really? 2? What happened to number 1? You know, it's like, I open it up, and it's like, wait a minute, this is, you know, my shipping list says number 1, and I open it up, and I read the inside, and it's Dead Man's Run, volume 1, number 1. And, you know, it's like, ooh, guess someone made a mistake. You know, so it's got number, you know, it's even to the point where the last page of the story,
you got it, the cover that had the girl on it.
Yeah,
the that last one page, says number 2.
Yeah,
the other cover says number 1.
Yeah, and even at the last page it says to be continued in Dead Man's Run issue number 2. And I'm like, okay. Oops. You know, so little bit of a mishap there that has nothing to do with my enjoyment of the story. It's just that's the kind of thing that really shouldn't happen. You know, it's,
well, the editor should catch it, the production people should catch it. You know, it's it makes it seem a lot more amateurish than it really is.
When you misprint issue 36 as issue 37 or vice versa, it's maybe more understandable because you're in a rut or something, then it's number 1. You know, it's like, how do you not put a number 1 on the cover of number 1? So, and you know what really is irritating here is that, so this comes out, it's a variant cover because Aspen's one of the companies that does, you know, multiple covers of every issue. So someone's there and they see the other cover, you know, cover A, and it says Dead Man's Run issue number 1. And then next to it is Dead Man Run, issue number 2, and it's a different cover. And, you know, well, we've seen 2 issues of Captain America very recently come out in the same week. You know, so is some poor fool out there somewhere who doesn't open them up, pick up, oh, issue number 1 and 2 came out, and they buy both of them.
Yeah.
Then they get home, and the insides are exactly the same. So,
Well, we've talked before about how confusing it can be with the multiple covers for an issue, and here's a case where the company itself got confused.
Yeah, so very, very bad foot to get off on. Then we get to the inside. So, I mean, all that is production, right? It's nothing to do with the story. You know, I'm not going to knock the story because they had, you know, some production problems on getting the right number on this particular cover. So we get to the story of this thing. And, you know, we're in Los Olivados, California, Andrew Jackson Maximum Security Federal Correction Facility. And we've got this jail. We've got this guy who's maybe a prison guard or something. He's got his sister. You know, they're driving in their car. And I'm going to give away some of the premise here. This is the kind of thing where the premise of the story from reading this, and just reading this comic, maybe I missed something. The premise of the comic seems to be this guy dies and he finds himself in hell.
Mm-hmm.
And what his mission is he's going to break out. He's going to break out of hell. Okay. So he's dead. Dead man's running. He's going to break his way out of hell. So, you know, we have a scene where, you know, and I've seen this kind of trope before, you know, someone's falling from great height, you know, there's the light shining down and he lands on a platform and it's like, oh, you know, now he's, you know, arms reaching up and stuff and he's in hell, you know, kind of thing. Only problem is the actual event where he dies, it's a car crash. And I like Tony Parker. Tony Parker who's the artist on this, mm-hmm. did a fabulous job on Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep adaptation over at Boom. But, boy, the art was really confusing on the actual car crash that killed him. And then we segue, and this has got to be story, not art. We segue into a flashback of Sam and his sister as little kids for a page that I wasn't really clear what that had to do anything. Oh, maybe it's like his life's flashing in front of his eyes as he dies or something. And then we flash to the, you know, falling down and there's all the weird, you know, hell stuff going on. Problem I had with this was, I mean, I'm 2/3 of the way into the issue and I'm really unclear on what the heck is going on. You know, it's like I'm kind of gleaning what the story is supposed to be, but the storytelling in this, which...
Well, let me see if I can shed some light on this, not having read the issue. Hell is this prison that no one can escape from,
yeah.
And it's not a metaphor. It's really this concrete, you know,
right.
Razor wire, gun towers, the whole, you know, prison thing in the middle of the California desert. That young cartographer, Sam yeah. Tinker, begins an epic battle with the mysterious warden and the horrors of her domain in a desperate attempt to rescue his sister Juniper, the only innocent in hell.
Yeah, I know.
It's like, that's, of course, from the solicit, but see, I've got it figured out. I don't see what the confusion is.
I'll tell you what, though, and this is one where I did go back and read the solicit. If I had not read the solicit, I wouldn't have known what the hell was going on in this issue.
Pun intended.
So it failed for me. I really wanted to like this issue because I really love Tony Parker. I like Greg Pak. Greg Pak has done some great things. I went into this with a really positive attitude, wanting to like it, but the issue just didn't click for me. You know, it's one that it ended up not getting added to my pull list. You know, so I gave it like a 3 out of 5. It might work for other people. The solicit text had me. It delivered what was in the solicit text, but, you know, it delivered what was in the solicit text in a way that if I'm reading the solicit text, I can see it. But standing alone, if I picked this issue up off the rack, I don't know that I could have written that solicit from reading the comic. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I see what you mean.
It wasn't a two-way thing. You know, it's like, you know, if I could read the solicit and see by looking at the comic – where that's reflected in there, but I don't think there's any way blind I would have picked this comic up. If I was to write down a description, it would not be anything close to what, you know, that that solicit text set.
Well, it's funny because I find that to be very common. I mean, I wouldn't have written the solicitation for Prophet 21 based on what I read in the thing as what they put out there. So I expect there to be huge difference sometimes between what's in the solicit and what's in the page. And really what's on the page matters because that's the actual story.
Sure. But, you know, in this case, when, you know, like Prophet, I pretty much could follow what was going on in the story.
Yes, yes.
And that was not. And maybe that's a failing on my part here, but, you know, it's just bottom line is I just, you know, said, okay, I'm not going to go forward with this.
Well, anytime you've got to go to the solicitation to make sense of the story has by definition failed. It did not have enough to be coherent in and of itself. And it's great to have mystery. It's great to have, you know, things to reveal later. But if you don't know what the hell's going on, that's a problem.
Yeah. And to me, again, very key moment in the series, in the issue, is that car crash and the death that's putting them in hell, and maybe they wanted to be ambiguous there. Well, they succeeded in that. But, I mean, it seems like it's a key moment to the issue, and it was, storytelling-wise for me, very unclear.
Well, it sounds like it's the moment that launches the story.
Yeah.
So for it to be unclear is a huge failure. Which has me a little surprised you giving it a 3 rating, because what I'm hearing sounds more like a 2.
It's, you're probably right. It was a 2. I mean, for me to drop and not continue with the series, it's a 2.
Not trying to lower the rating, I'm just saying that...
You're right. You're right. That's probably like my intrinsic, I don't want to ding these guys, but, you know, legitimately, it should be a 2 for me. Now, on the other side of that, I read one more book here, and I don't know if you picked this one up or not. Lord of the Jungle, number one.
I picked it up. I have not read it.
This is a number one issue. It was a buck. It was from Dynamite. I read this issue. I thought it was very well done. The art and the story, it's a direct, well, maybe not. It's been a while since I've read the Tarzan book. With various artistic license, it's basically an adaptation of Edgar Rice Burroughs' very first Tarzan book, which I guess is in public domain, though the Tarzan name is still copyrighted, which is why they're calling it Lord of the Jungle instead of Tarzan.
Right.
But it's Tarzan. You know, so it's pretty much an adaptation of the Tarzan story. You know, the Greystokes are marooned in Africa. You know, they build the treehouse. The mother has the baby. You know, they end up,
I've seen the animated feature. I loved it.
Yeah, but
Phil Collins was like, great.
You know, both of them end up dead, and the baby is adopted by the apes to grow up and become Tarzan. Anyway, if you've never read a Tarzan comic before, I'd say, yeah, you know, maybe pick this up. I mean, the problem is that I've read the Marvel adaptation of Tarzan, the DC adaptation of Tarzan, probably at least one or two other. I mean, Tarzan's been around the block before.
Oh, yeah.
And I just didn't see anything here that I have not seen before. Especially, I mean, for a buck, hey, you know, what the heck? Pick the thing up. You know, it was a decent comic, but... You know, Dynamite, it's going to pop to $3.99 with the next issue. I saw nothing here that would cause me to want to buy this for $3.99 an issue.
I got the first issue because it was a buck. I don't think I've pre-ordered any of the others based on, you know, wanting to read the first issue first. And you're right, Tarzan's been around the block a couple of times in TV, cartoon, comics, etc. So, can they do something cool with him or not?
And not in this issue. I mean, you had some things that were different than previous incarnations of the characters. Little storytelling moments here and there. I mean, it's not identical, but the differences that are in here were not sufficient to make me want to read basically the same story another time. You know what I mean?
Understandable, yeah.
While there was nothing wrong with it, there was nothing... enough right with it to make me want to read the same story again. But, you know, again, as I'm saying, if no one has ever actually read Tarzan before in some form or another, it's a good story. And, you know, maybe this be the way that you're first exposed to it. So this is a 3 for me.
Okay.
but just getting the number ones out of my system, you know.
Yeah, I got it. I just haven't had time to read it yet, so it's been a busy week for me. Matter of fact, I haven't read anything except the ones we've talked about. So you got anything else, or does that pretty much do it?
Is it for me?
Cool.
Join us next week when we discuss I, Vampire, number 5 from DC, Alpha Flight, number 8 from Marvel, and King Conan, Phoenix on the Sword, number 1 from Dark Horse Comics.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.